Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1999. Deliberate Deception.
Hello. In our weekly discussions here, I sometimes use careless language, which leads to misunderstanding, and when I do, I'm sorry for it. The problem is that I really have a great deal of work to do, and I usually don't have time to refine and polish my remarks before I go on the air, and so sometimes I don't make myself as clear as I might. One listener criticized last week's broadcast because I referred to Ayn Rand as a Soviet Jewess who preached a religion of selfishness. He wrote to me that that was like saying that Ayn Rand was a believer in both communism and in self-reliance and individualism at the same time, and that didn't make sense. Actually, my reference to Ayn Rand as a Soviet Jewess was intended to mean only that she was a Jewess from the Soviet Union, not that she was an apostle of communism. Unlike many of her fellow Jews at the time, she did not preach communism. She was, however, an apostle not only of selfishness, but also of other destructive ideas preached by nearly all of her fellow Jews, such as the idea that race doesn't matter. In her book, The Virtue of Selfishness, after railing vehemently and at length against what she called collectivism, she wrote, and I quote, "Racism is the lowest, most crudely primitive form of collectivism," end quote. Furthermore, Ayn Rand's brand of selfishness was a far cry from the sort of self-reliance and individual responsibility in which I believe. The atomistic sort of selfishness she preached was intended, again I say intended, to sever a person from his racial roots, to kill his feeling for his race, to lead him to put his personal interests above his responsibilities to his race as a whole, and in fact to abjure his racial responsibilities altogether. And this was deliberate. I don't like to sound spooky or irrational about this, but I should tell you that many years of experience have led me to believe that a maxim we all ought to be guided by is, "No good thing cometh out of Israel." When a Jew preaches anything to us, whether collectivism, as in the case of Karl Marx, or extreme individualism, as in the case of Ayn Rand, it is intended to do us harm, to deceive us, to weaken us, to make us more vulnerable. Even when it appears to be anti-communism, it is slyly twisted so as to equate communism with every form of collective feeling, and from there to make any form of racial feeling akin to communism. And as I said, this is done very slyly, very cleverly, so that it fools many people, especially the simpletons of the right. Many anti-communists today have let themselves be persuaded by Rand and her cohorts that racism is a form of communism. 1,000 generations of practice in the marketplace have given Rand and her fellow tribesmen a rare talent for deception, for misdirection. Let me mention a specific example of this. According to all accounts, the defining event for the Jews of the world today is the so-called Holocaust. More professional Jews, that is, Jews whose profession is their Jewishness, make their living today from the Holocaust than from anything else connected with their Jewishness. It was, they tell us, the most horrible crime in the history of the world. And they have trained a lot of Christian preachers and Gentile politicians and Gentile media hacks to say the same thing. And they have been sending to all of us the bill for this alleged most horrible crime in history for quite a while now. First, it was the Nazis, those terrible people in Germany who, for some inexplicable reason, didn't like Jews, and so, beginning in 1933, tried to get them all out of Germany by prohibiting them from owning newspapers or radio stations or practicing law and so on. And then, after the start of the Second World War, began putting them in concentration camps. So, after the Second World War, the Nazis were hounded and hunted down and murdered wholesale. The Jews still gloat over that and complain among themselves that they didn't get to kill as many as they wanted to. Now, if you're confused because that image of the bloodthirsty, gloating Jew doesn't quite match the image presented by Hollywood of the lovable, benevolent, funny, clever, and helpful Jew, the wise, thoughtful, humanitarian Jew presented to you every day on your television screen, let me read you part of an article which appeared in a New York Jewish newspaper just 3 weeks ago. The article is in the November 26th edition of the Jewish Press, and it was written by New York Jewish Assemblyman Dov Heikind. It's about a Jewish organization with the Hebrew name Nakam, an organization that certainly would be called a hate group if it weren't Jewish, of course. Assemblyman Heikind writes, and I quote, "Recently, two elderly Holocaust survivors proudly related their involvement in Nakam, a brigade of survivors who attempted to avenge the murders of their families. In a documentary made for Nuremberg TV, Liebke Distel and Joseph Harmatz, both nearing 80, confirmed that they had conspired to kill Nazis by poisoning their bread with arsenic. Regrettably, the arsenic wasn't potent enough, and the German POWs became ill but did not die. It's a shame that the tens of thousands of Nazis who avoided capture and punishment did not suffer at the hands of their former victims." End quote. Assemblyman Heikind then goes on to rage that some Germans have had the nerve to suggest that the two Jewish poisoners should be put on trial for war crimes. Oy vey, the very idea of punishing Jews for crimes against Germans gives Heikind a fit. It's fine for Jews to track down 80-year-old Germans alleged to have killed Jews during the war and send them off for a show trial somewhere. There's good money in that for the Jews, although Heikind doesn't put it quite that way. What he says about the Germans is this, and I quote, "There should not be a moment of peace for those who committed those horrible crimes. They should never feel secure, should never enjoy the tranquility of a family life they tore from so many," end quote. But as for the Jews who murdered Germans after the war, why, of course, they should not be punished. They were just nice Jewish boys doing what comes naturally for Jews, and regrettably, they didn't use enough arsenic. Anyway, the contrast between the bloodthirsty hatefulness displayed by Heikind talking to his fellow Jews in the Jewish press and the image of the Jews presented to us by Hollywood is instructive, I believe. It's also instructive to contrast Heikind's account of this arsenic episode in the November 26th Jewish press with what really happened. In 1945 and 1946, in the months after the Germans surrendered and the Democratic and Communist occupation forces moved in, the Jews were running wild in Germany. Under the protection of the occupation armies, bands of Jews murdered thousands of disarmed Germans. Going from door to door at night, they took Germans out and shot them or cut their throats. But that wasn't enough for the Jews. They wanted to kill Germans in much larger numbers. And so they decided to poison the water supplies for several major German cities. By the time the Jews had gotten the poison together, however, the cities of Germany were swarming with hundreds of thousands of Jews released from the concentration camps who had miraculously managed to avoid the gas chambers. And the poisoners were afraid that some of these Jews might be killed if they poisoned the water supplies. They decided to poison German prisoners of war instead. On the night of April 13, 1946, two Jews broke into a bakery in Nuremberg, which supplied bread to a large German POW camp. They poisoned 3,000 loaves of bread with arsenic. Several hundred German prisoners who ate the poisoned bread the next day died a painful death, and several thousand were hospitalized. But New York Assemblyman Dolf Heikind rages that not enough arsenic was used. If they had used more arsenic, then they could have killed thousands instead of hundreds, and he finds it regrettable that that didn't happen. Now, 54 years later, the supply of German POWs has pretty well dried up. So the Jews have announced that it's all of the German people, including those born after the war, that must be held responsible for mistreating the Jews. They must pay and pay and pay because they committed the most horrible crime in history. And in fact, we all must pay. It was the Germans who did it, but we let them do it. So we must pay too. We must continue to support the bandit state of Israel financially, militarily, and diplomatically. We must wage war against Israel's neighbors when they fail to obey a United Nations directive or when we suspect that they are trying to develop weapons of mass destruction. But Israel can ignore all the UN directives it wants, continue to develop new Jewish settlements in territory stolen from its neighbors, continue to torture Palestinian prisoners and dynamite the homes of their families, and continue to build up its illegal stocks of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, and we must look the other way. That's because we owe the Jews a free ride, right? It's because we didn't stop the Germans from mistreating those nice Jewish boys soon enough. We let what they call the most horrible crime in history happen, and so we must pay. I always have been amazed at how well this swindle works. Of course, it's easier to swindle a nation when you control what that nation sees on its television screens. But still, I am surprised at the gullibility of my own people, at how easily they are deceived. I am surprised, even though the swindlers, as I said a moment ago, have a rare talent for deception. I mean, just look at the facts. The Jews call what the Germans did to them the most horrible crime in history. Consider what the Jews did to the Russians, to the Ukrainians, to the Poles, and to the Balts, not to mention what they did to the Germans. A conservative estimate of the number of Russians and Ukrainians killed by Jewish communism between the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 and the end of the Second World War is 30 million. Now, even if one accepts the canonical figure of 6 million Jews killed in the so-called Holocaust, that alleged most horrible crime in history is dwarfed by the slaughter of Slavs and Balts by the Jews. In the Baltic countries before the war, the Communist Party was a kosher enterprise consisting almost exclusively of Jews. When the Red Army occupied Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia in 1940 and installed communist governments, Jewish commissars began arresting and murdering what they called the class enemy, but which really was the Gentile enemy. Teachers, professors, writers, policemen, military officers, businessmen, doctors, even lawyers were rounded up by the secret police and then murdered, sometimes after horrible tortures. The Jews wanted no one left alive who might be looked upon as a leader by the masses. They murdered more than 60,000 members of the leadership elite in tiny Estonia alone, which had a total population of only 1.2 million. They decapitated the Baltic countries. They did the same thing in Poland, only they didn't have a chance to do it on such a huge scale because the Germans seized the larger part of Poland, including most of the cities, before the Reds did. But in the part of Poland occupied by the Red Army, the Jewish commissars rounded up 15,000 Polish leaders, mostly military officers, and murdered them. The Germans later discovered the corpses of more than 4,000 of them in mass graves in a forest near the Russian village of Katyn. The rest have never been found. The Jews complain loudly today that when the Germans liberated the Baltic countries in 1941, the local Balts were much more eager to kill Jews than the Germans were. The Germans had to hold the Balts back for the sake of order. And in Poland, at the end of the war, after the Germans had left and before the Reds had clamped down, there were several mass lynchings of Jews by the Poles. In the Polish town of Kielce in 1946, for example, the local Poles killed 43 Jews before the communists could stop them. The Jews claimed to have no clue as to why the Balts and the Poles hated them so much. They pretend that it's a mystery to them. Why should those nasty Slavs and Balts want to hurt the poor, inoffensive, long-suffering humanitarian Jews who have done so much for mankind? And even today, American school children are much more likely to hear about the 43 Jews killed in Kielce by the Poles in 1946 than they are about the 15,000 Polish leaders killed by the Jews in the Katyn Forest and elsewhere in 1940. And they are quite unlikely to hear about the deliberate poisoning of German POWs after the war by Jews, just as they are unlikely to hear any genuine expression of sentiment by leading Jews, such as New York Assemblyman Dove Hikins' expression of regret that the Jewish poisoners didn't use enough arsenic. You know, the history of the Second World War is a big and complex subject. So is the so-called Holocaust. There are many aspects of both of these subjects which still ought to be investigated to determine where the truth lies. But most of the misunderstanding which exists today is not due to the complexity of the subjects. It is due to deliberate deception. The mass murder of the elites of the Baltic countries is not something which is too complex for the average American to understand. It is simply something which the people who control the mass media in America prefer that the average citizen not know. What they want the average citizen to think about is how the poor, blameless Jews suffered through no fault of their own, and how we didn't do anything to stop their suffering, and so we owe them a free ride today. One can read specialized history books to learn about the genocide committed against the Balts and the Poles and the Ukrainians by the Jews. One can even read a little about this genocide in the Encyclopedia Britannica. But no school teacher in America will mention it for fear of losing his or her job. In America's public schools, just as on television, genocide means only one thing: the killing of the poor, blameless Jews by the wicked anti-Semites of the world, especially the Nazis. And since Americans don't read specialized history books, and very few of them ever pick up an encyclopedia, what Steven Spielberg says about genocide in his movies is what most Americans believe it is. That's deliberate deception. And this deception has serious consequences. I am sure that many Americans believe that what happened in a war that ended 55 years ago is no longer relevant and certainly not worth arguing about. But even if I and every other Gentile agreed not to belabor the issue anymore, the Jews wouldn't agree. They're making too much money from it. And that's not just the billions. They're shaking down the Swiss and the Germans and the French and everybody else for. The extortion money is the least of it. Much more important is the psychic aspect, the feeling on the part of a brainwashed public that it's reprehensible to criticize Jews for anything because they have suffered so much more than anything else and through no fault of their own, poor dears. That's why people are afraid to say anything about Jewish media control in America, afraid even to acknowledge its reality. And Jewish media control is destroying America, destroying our civilization, destroying our race. Virtually every destructive policy coming from Washington, immigration policy, affirmative action, forced school integration, the promotion of feminism and homosexuality, the ramming of multiculturalism down our throats, you name it, is a consequence of Jewish control of the mass media. So it is important to get over this feeling that the Jews shouldn't be criticized or held accountable. And to get over it, we need to understand what really happened during and after the war and why it happened. I have one more comment on this subject. I am often criticized, sometimes even denounced in extreme terms, because of what some listeners believe is bloody-mindedness on my part. Some people thought that it was just terrible that I spoke last week about putting politicians' heads on poles outside the community latrine. What an uncivilized thing to say. Some people suggested that this shows that I am not really sane, that I am filled with barely repressed homicidal impulses. Well, I have spent more time than my critics, I believe, acquainting myself with what goes on in the real world. I have spent much time studying the details of what the Jews did to the Estonians and to the Ukrainians and to the Poles and also to the Germans. These are terrible and uncivilized things, but they are real. Just because Steven Spielberg never will make a movie about them makes them no less real and no less terrible. And it is my knowledge of the reality of these terrible things, my conviction that this is what the world is really like, and that the terrible things that happened before, that happened to us, to our people, will happen again if we let them happen. And we won't stop them from happening by sipping tea and engaging in polite conversation with the people who are responsible for these things happening. We must deal with the real world. And the real world has been a bloody and terrible place in the past. And I firmly believe that it will continue to be that way. Survival is a bloody business. Let us not be fooled by our momentary comforts into believing otherwise. The mess that we are in presently is more likely to be resolved by somebody's heads being put on poles than it is by being polite and avoiding the more unpleasant aspects of reality. I'm not really obsessed by the desire to cut off the heads of any group of people, not even the heads of the politicians. But I am obsessed by the idea that we must not, through our inaction or our insistence on being polite and civilized, allow the enemies of our people to do again to us what they did in Estonia, or in Ukraine, or in the Katyn Forest, or in the prisoner of war camp at Nuremberg. And as long as they continue in their efforts to deceive us, as long as they continue in their efforts to prevent people like me from contradicting them, I will continue to be obsessed. Thanks for being with me again today.